Good evening. If you want to open your Bibles, our first reading will come from 2 Timothy chapter 1 in just a moment. 2 Timothy chapter 1. And it was interesting that our brother prayed for me to be able to have a ready recollection and remember everything, because lately I've been trying to do better at memorizing all the main points and get out from behind the podium and just have a conversation with you all and not be too dependent on my notes. But I did not get a chance to very much memorize this outline. I have some of the main parts of it. And then part of the other part of it is, I never imagined how hard it would be to memorize when to come over and hit the clicker. And so that's the other part that I'm learning here as I try to add that skill set to my attempts to try to be casual in my conversations with you all about very serious things. I know we have the Hamilton girls here with us who both love soccer. So I want you to imagine an 8 and 6-year-old Sam and Chris sitting on a fold-out couch in 1999 as they watch the World Cup, the U.S. women's team against China, go down to penalty shootout kickout to see who would win the game. And those two little girls sat there in Massachusetts, and they had a 0.00036% chance of being able to make the Olympic team. And sure enough, on July 1st, they connected in a friendly game against Mexico for the first sister-to-sister assist goal in U.S. international soccer. And if you can convince your parents, at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, they will play for the semifinal in the Olympics. And so those two girls, what went from being a 0.000, I don't know how many, 386% chance, they're now 9%, since there's two of them, 9% of the U.S. women's team of 22 girls that will go out to play. And so I saw this headline, Story of the World's Greatest Soccer Sisters, and I wondered, well, I might know them. It's probably the Hamilton girls. I ought to read this article. And so I clicked on it, and it was actually about the I think you pronounce it the Mewis girls, Christine and Sam, if I remember right, are their full names. And so you can read more about that, about how those parents brought up the world's greatest soccer sisters. I saw that headline, and it reminded me of something from a long time ago. I'd been given an assignment to speak for a church. They asked me, say, I want you to speak about growing faithful children. I thought that word was interesting. We usually say raising faithful children. They said growing faithful children. And so in my curiosity, I searched for some titles to find some stories to illustrate this. And a headline came up about how to grow a super athlete. And this is from the New York Times. It was a very old article. When I was doing the research in 2018, this article of 2007 is what came up. And so when I saw this story about the girls, I was reminded of this lesson, this illustration that I wanted to share with you all tonight. The New York Times article on how to grow a super athlete, I thought was an interesting, it got my attention up, because what it talked about how is how there were certain geographical areas where they are hot spots for sports. You might be able to think of some on your own. The South Koreans produce really good female golfers. The Dominican Republic produces very good baseball players. To Philip's offense, the Canadians produce really good hockey players. And so the question the article was asking is, why is it that certain regional areas, geographical areas, produce super athletes? And this article was focusing on women's tennis. So I don't know if Sylvia is watching at home on Zoom, but I found out this week Sylvia loves to play tennis. And this one was, why do so many great female tennis players come from Moscow, Russia? But not only that, very specifically, Spartak Club in Moscow, Russia. At the time of this article, Russia had half of the top 10 international women's players in tennis. How does a country produce half of the top 10? And not only that then, but 3 of the top 6 Russians come from Spartak. This picture you see on the screen, you're saying, that looks like a dingy place. It is. Spartak is a dump. It's hidden in an obscure city park in Moscow, Russia. It has one indoor court, and because the heater on it is most of the time broken, the kids play tennis in coats. You may say, well, that might be part of the secret right there. They have to train in coats, and then all of a sudden they get to go someplace where they take the coats off, and they feel free. That might be part of it. And the question they're asking is, what causes athletic dominance? And you may all be saying, well, why are we talking so much about sports? There were spiritual lessons, spiritual parallels. What made for successful athletes can also make for spiritually successful children. There was a long discussion at one point about how our body protects the nervous system. And here's where it read. This is the only little bit of science you're going to get. This is to kind of get the kids back in the mood for doing their science lessons, and school is right around the corner. Hate to bring that up. Those of you teachers, you know, get to remind you of what photosynthesis is. It's the only science reading we're going to have here. But in this biological nervous system that God has given us, they were analyzing all this, and it said this. It said, if the new science is right, and nerve protection is the talent, as photosynthesis is the plant growth, then Spartek makes it abundantly clear that photosynthesis alone is never enough. You also need soil, water, air, sunlight, and luck. The question then becomes, which variables are helping Spartek's abundant success? Well, this is very interesting. We understand the analogy to plants, right? It's not just photosynthesis that allowed all this vegetation to grow so well here in Colorado this spring and summer, right? It was the photosynthesis process mixed in with the fact that we had more rain than usual, more water than usual. And those of you who garden, you understand the importance of the fact that you have to have the right kind of soil for your gardens to produce vegetables this time of year. Just can't be any old soil. You put special things into the dirt. Not because you doubt the process of photosynthesis, but because you understand it all works together. So the article went on to explore, okay, what makes these athletes so special? And here were the four things that this article highlighted, and I think what you will see is with each of these, there's a great spiritual parallel for how we can grow faithful children. They found that the children that had risen to the top from Spartek Club had driven parents. They started early. They had powerful and consistent coaches, or coaching, you might say, and then cultural toughness. And so these are the four things that are also needed to grow or raise, if you like the word raise better, grow faithful children. The first one's fairly obvious. We all think about, well, yeah, duh, that does need to happen. What about those who don't have strong, driven parents? Well, remember that is the story behind Paul, right? In 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 3, we know these ladies well, and it's good to remember this. I thank God, whom I serve with a clear conscience, the way my forefathers did, as I constantly remember you in my prayers, night and day, longing to see you, even as I recall your tears, so I may be filled with joy. For I am mindful of the sincere faith within you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice. For I am sure that it is in you as well. For this reason, I remind you to kindle afresh the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. You see here a thing for us to think about if we're in the role of grandparents. Timothy's dad played no role but his mother and grandmother. So if you're in the case of, well, I'm a grandparent, maybe you're thinking, I've already missed my chance because I didn't have that early start. It's not over for your grandchildren. And it probably isn't as over for your adult children as you might think. But you can be a driven parent or you can be a driven grandparent. And then when we are entrusted with raising children, we need to have this kind of drive and focus that does what parents do. And so both of these stories, the U.S. women's soccer girls and these Spartak Russian girls, there were lots of sacrifices that were made for these children's hobbies. And I want to be very intentional to emphasize this word, hobbies. Sports is only one of the possible hobbies. We sometimes like to pick on sports families in America because they give too much to their sports. But you can be equally obsessed with any of the hobbies. Marching band, art perhaps, the love of the outdoors. Any of these hobbies can be taken to an extreme. But here's what hobbies have in common. They take a sacrifice of money. They take a sacrifice of time. And they take a sacrifice of energy. Most of us are probably not lazy parents. We're probably involved parents. And so we need to think about, what does that mean spiritually speaking? How involved are you in the spiritual growth of your family? Children or grandchildren? Or great-grandchildren, if somebody's here who has that case. I didn't stop to think about that. The money part of it. The U.S. family estimates that they spend annually, the girls started when they were 8 and 6, okay? Annually, on average, anywhere from $10,000 to $12,000 a year on soccer. And we might take away from that, rightfully, that's extreme. That was way too much money. But instead, what I hope we'll take away from that is, how much are we willing to spend on our spiritual success of our kids? So do you invest your energy and your time and your money into daily spiritual growth of your children? One mom said this whenever I was asking about the affordability of some things they were doing with their children. It was directly connected to their spiritual health. And the mom's response to me when I was asking about the affordability of it, they said, "We'll spend anything to put our kid in the right environment." Is that the attitude we have? And again, it's not just your children, but your grandchildren. Are you willing to spend anything to put your children or grandchildren in the right spiritual environment? How driven are we as parents that these children and grandchildren grow up to love the Lord? If we want them to turn out spiritually the way these Russian girls are turning out athletically, we've got to be driven and make sacrifices. They have got to know that it is our number one goal for them. As 3 John verse 4 says, "I have no greater joy than to hear my children are walking in truth." And so it does take some foresight, some planning to recognize if you're going to be married and have the possibility of children, then you need to be thinking forward to how are we going to have an early start on this process. Their early focus led to an elimination of distractions. With Spartak, there were some very interesting answers about this. Most of the girls didn't own video games. Sorry, Scott. They also, sorry, Emma and Lydia, didn't stress academics. So an early start that eliminated distractions. And this is not just Spartak, but I found this interesting. The stories y'all probably heard about some of our celebrities here in the Western world, in America, and the role that they played with technology. Barack Obama's girls, during the school year, they were allowed no TV except on weekends. How many Christians have made similar rules? Especially considering we might have, maybe some would say we do have. Well, I'll just leave it at Mike because I don't know anything about Barack and Michelle's personal values in TV shows. But we probably even see some of the TV shows that are being watched as more dangerous than even they would. But it wasn't for them about whether or not that show was dangerous. It was just you turn it off during the week. Elimination of distractions. Bill Gates had strict phone rules for his children. His children were not allowed to have phones until they were 14. They were never allowed to have the phones at the table. And they never had the phones after 9 p.m. You would think a guy as tech savvy and as wealthy as Bill Gates would be, I just wouldn't have expected to find that his rule. I was impressed by this early rule that he was, you know, controlling how they would maybe use their free time. And Steve Jobs. Have y'all heard this story? A reporter one time asked him about his children and the iPad that Steve had helped make be a possible thing for us. And his surprise comment to the journalist was, "iPads are banned in our house." You thought Bill Gates was strict. How about a complete outright ban on them? Yet some of our Christian homes haven't even looked at some of these possibilities or some of these necessities to have, be able to help think about how do we fill their free time. I'll admit to you, I struggle with Spartak shielding them from academics. I think it is okay for some tennis stars to know how to do math because, frankly, scoring in tennis is really hard. But I did once meet a gifted and talented advanced academic teacher who really surprised me in their orientation at the start of school. I looked around the room. There were some different tiger moms in the room where you could see the way they were taking notes and the way that they had managed their children. They were there to make 4.0s. And this was elementary school. But they were getting serious fast. I wasn't sure if I really belonged in this academic environment, gifted and talented. The lady's up there talking, and she says, literally with her hands clasped, she goes, "If you can do one thing for me this year, one thing." And all the parents were ready to hear whatever it was the gifted and talented teacher was going to say, because this was the secret to the top of gifted and talented. And she said, "Please, I beg you, let them go outside and play." Instead of hours inside reading and doing homework, let your children play. So how do we fill our kids' free time? Our first problem might be that they don't have any free time. Are we They overbooked. And again, if you're saying, well, Coulter, I've already, my children are grown and raised, well, you can have an influence on how are those adult children are raising your grandchildren. Don't be scared. If you've noticed that your grandchildren are overbooked with sporting activities, say something about it. Help them to set priorities. Nothing wrong with loving sports, but remind them how to set priorities. He's a old story that nobody's ever heard of his name anymore now, but back whenever he was a McDonald's All-American, I love to tell the story of McDonald's All-American Scotty Reynolds. He was famous for high school comebacks. You may say, well, why would he have to come back? Why, if he's such a great McDonald's All-American, why didn't his team just get off to the lead in the first quarter and coast all the way to the end? Because he had a lot of games on Wednesday nights. And he had become this celebrity figure in his little small town high school he played in because he'd come running in Wednesday night, shedding his Wednesday night gear with only about a quarter and a half left, and they'd come from behind. Scotty Reynolds to the rescue again. He came late because of Bible class to the varsity high school games. When he made it to the Division I NCAA athletics, he one time got benched in a tournament game. He was a starter, and they asked him, Why'd you bench Scotty? He skipped shoot around this morning because he said he had to go to church. The game was a Sunday night game, and they had had a shoot around practice a Sunday morning. If you missed that practice, then you were going to be benched. Scotty sat the bench for a tournament game because a shoot around wasn't as important as going to worship God. So early on, set the priorities. Help the kids to see how important it is to be at Bible class and worship. The family habits need to start early and start young. I'm reminded of the passage that we've often turned to about families and loving God in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on your doorposts of your house and on your gates." Everywhere the children go, every time there's a free moment, it can be a time to think about spiritual things. Your kids might roll your eyes at you. Lydia does. We'll be on a hike and we'll notice something and I'll start up and she can already tell just by the first few words. She goes, "Here he goes again, another sermon." And it's not just because I'm a preacher. There are spiritual lessons in everyday life everywhere you look. And you may say, well, I can't do that. Well, then what you can do is you can encourage the reading. There's great children's books available today that maybe there weren't as plentiful whenever we were children. So if you don't know about some of these books, I want to share a few of them with you. The Big Picture Storybook of the Bible. It is a beautiful book that helps show the overall picture of how this world fits together from Genesis to Revelation. My children have read through it cover to cover many times. It's a great one. Buy it for your grandchildren. Here's another one that I thought was interesting. The Jesus Storybook Bible. This one has a subtitle that I think is very interesting. The subtitle is, "Every Story Whispers His Name." And so as you're reading through the Old Testament stories always end with saying, and this is like when Jesus said or when Jesus did. So how cool is it that there's a little children's storybook that when they're reading about the bronze serpent that was lifted up that saved the ones who were dying in Israel, that story ends with saying, and one day Jesus would say, when he is lifted up, you look to him for salvation. You're connecting the dots for children at ages 2 and 3 and 4, long before some of us, even as adults in our 30s and 40s, ever saw some of these connections. I am thankful that God has given us resources like this. And if you think, well, those just look too colorful and pretty for, they must be meant more for girls. What about for boys? Well, listen to this title right here. This one's called The Biggest Story Ever Told, but the subtitle on this one is How the Snake Crusher Brings Us Back to the Garden. You don't think that would resonate with Emerson? I've been over to their house. He loves to tell me about how he's eating food out of his garden. They've actually caught snakes in the backyard, Chuck's yard. This is a great subtitle for young boys to hear, that there's a snake crusher who's going to bring us back to the garden. I hope you know what that's alluding to, right? The idea that Jesus is going to crush Satan, as promised there in Genesis chapter 3, and allow us to come back to the presence of God in the Garden of Eden. What an incredible way to tell to a young boy the biggest story ever told, the best story that's ever told. And finally, one I think y'all have heard me talk about before, the garden, the curtain, and the cross. Again, 7 minutes. You don't even have to buy this one. You can watch this one be read by the author and the illustrator, either choice. They both have it for free on YouTube. You can watch one of them read it. And I even have a Spanish edition. And in 7 minutes, the whole gospel story tied up in these three words, garden, curtain, cross, that sticks with kids. And that helps them remember how great of a God we serve. And you can start this early. Early, these can be the stories you read them before they go to bed. And as they mature, it can change what we used to do. And we need to get back into this routine. I will admit to you, my family's fallen out of our routine. Cindy had warned us about Colorado. She said, you're going to get lots of company. And we have had so much company. We have no routine at the Wickerham House right now. We need to get it back. One of the things we used to do, and I loved it, is when we would gather around a dinner table. And I don't know, I should have been doing this even with my company. Just forced my company to join us in our family worship. But what we would do is we would read a psalm together. We would read one psalm every night whenever we had dinner. And just ask, what'd you hear? What'd you notice? What questions do you have? Their observations and their questions will be fascinating, and it'll help instill in them a love for the Lord at a young age. We know these verses that we're about to say here. Raise a child in the way he should go, and he will not depart from it. Proverbs 22, verse 6. Fathers, do not provoke your children, but raise them up in the way of the Lord. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. We know these verses. The trouble is sometimes life gets so busy we forget to execute them. I'll give you another Old Testament concept before we move on to the third thing that helped raise these children. In Exodus chapter 12, we learned at the Passover feast, they would gather around the table, and remember there was a job for one of the boys. One of the boys would speak up and ask to the father, why do we do this feast? And then the father instructed him about how Jehovah had saved him and all the things that Jehovah had saved them from. I think sometimes what happens is we just kind of take it all for granted and assume that our kids are going to get it by osmosis because we drag them to church all the time. You really ought to stop at some point and make sure your children and grandchildren understand what God has saved us from. Answer their why. When they may not have the why, but eventually they'll have it. But in Exodus, it was commanded. You would get it every year at Passover. Why do we do this? And the father would give an answer. Fathers, you can give an answer about why you love the Lord. It's nothing that needs to be scripted out by some professional preacher or Bible class teacher or elder or deacon. You tell them why you were saved and why you gratefully returned worship to him who saved you. The third thing that they said that the athletes there is that they had powerful, consistent coaching. God has given us mentors in our lives, and we need to grant these mentors the ability to speak truthfully to our families. If your family doesn't have a family you look up to say, we want to be like that family, you need to get one. You need to have a family in which you point to your children and you say, that is who we hope to grow up to be like. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12, Paul wrote this to him. He said, but we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction. Other translations say that you respect those who diligently labor among you. So 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 12. How do we talk about leaders around them, spiritual leaders? How do we talk about their Bible class teachers? How do we talk about their elders? How do we talk about the preachers that they get exposed to? Let me be very careful about what I'm about to say because this is something that's not in the notes here, so I'm going to have to try to say this with the right tone. Be very careful what you feed them about their Bible class teachers, elders, and deacons, and the preacher. It's very tempting to subconsciously talk about some of the adults in the church that end up being the ones that are downstairs teaching them. And what they've heard you say about them will impact their receptiveness to what those adults then are saying.
The way I usually hear this taught is that people talk about don't roast the preacher on the way home from worship to lunch. It's not just the preacher. Y'all roast me all you want, maybe, I guess. I don't know. I'm not really going to be bothered by it because I usually don't end up hearing about it. What I'm worried about is that we roast elders and deacons and Bible class teachers too. Here's the part that's off notes. I have heard about revolts from high school kids who refused to go to the high school class because they didn't like who was assigned to them to be their teacher. Brethren, we should never allow our children to get to the point where they think that's acceptable behavior. I refuse to go to the high school class as long as that person's teaching. There may be some exceptions to this general rule that I've just stated of sexual harassment or some terrible thing that needs to be discussed in more private ways. But generally speaking, if you have some teenagers who group together to say, we refuse to go in there if that's the one who's teaching us, you might have a bigger problem on your hand than an awkward teacher. And it may have started with the way that we talk about one another. So do we model respect and admiration for the co-workers in the kingdom? You notice how many times Paul talks about his co-workers? Y'all are my co-workers. We got to be careful how we talk about one another. Do we lift them up to our children and say, be like that godly man? Or do we criticize them? The Spartak article was interesting because what it stressed was that their coaches were very consistent. They said the problem in U.S. tennis is the U.S. tennis coaches try to be different and unique. The U.S. coaches say, how can I be different than all the other coaches to try to draw attention to their special system, right? And meanwhile, the Russians are just doing the same thing over and over and over again. And look at how the results are proving themselves. Sometimes what we can do is we try to be so impressively different that we forget that here's what we need. We need spiritual leaders, not who entertain us. We need spiritual leaders who challenge us. How well do we warn and discourage unhealthy coach partnerships? We warned a little bit about this recently, so I'm trying not to be too repetitive in my emphasis of this. But again, we're talking about being careful about who we're married to. Because our spouse is our coach, in a sense, or our co-teammate there. And the influence they have over us could be very damaging. And so I'll tell you one more thing about consistent coaching and mentoring. If you find yourself in this position, are you strong enough to warn someone when they're about to make a mistake? There's more that I will save about that idea in other lessons. But at times it may need to be that in our coaching we have to go to someone and say, you are choosing a terrible partner for the game of life, and it could ruin you. The fourth thing they emphasized was cultural toughness. This is the one that I smiled by being entertained by it and thought it was good at the same time. At Spartak, they do not call it playing tennis. At Spartak, you do not play tennis. They call it Barotsa. No, I don't know if I said that Russian word correctly, but I can tell you what Barotsa is supposed to mean. To struggle. You come to Spartak to struggle at tennis, not to play tennis. And as we talked about earlier, they suffer adversity. It was a dump, remember, where they trained. Did not have a working heater. And so here's the question I want to ask us, and we'll read a passage here from Romans chapter 5. Are we willing to let our children suffer hardships? Look at Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 3. In Romans chapter 5, verse 3, listen to this. It says, and not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope, and hope does not disappoint. Because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. For while we were still helpless at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man, someone would dare even to die. But God demonstrates his own love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us.
God let his son suffer hardship. And there is a concern, y'all have heard me talk about this before, and I'm afraid I might be too judgy in this area, but let me go ahead and say just a general warning that each one of us needs to spend some time meditating on. I'm afraid of a society in which there are too many parents who are adopting an enabling mentality that never is willing to let them suffer, never able to challenge them to suffer hardship. And what Paul's saying here is, he says, we exult. That means we enjoy tribulations. What are you talking about, Paul? He said, I'm glad because tribulation makes me stronger. It gives me proven character. So some of our greatest lessons are learned under hardships. So let me challenge you to think deeply about parenthood and fatherhood and ask this question. Who is the greatest father of all time? Jehovah, our God. Our merciful Father, yes. And so this consideration here raises a whole host of issues that are worthy of consideration. The fact that he is the perfect Father, perfect example for us, he is merciful, yes. But he also allowed Israel to suffer consequences. And in the case of Jesus, allowed his son to suffer the consequences that weren't even his own fault. They weren't even because of his own sin. But the way that some of us are expecting to live life is in this fake utopia of we should never have to suffer. It's not realistic. The song we sang, I think it was this morning, it talks about how sweet it would be for our children to suffer as the fathers did, that they would die for thee. Have you really thought about what you're singing when you sing that song? Celebrating the idea that your children might become martyrs? How in the world do you ever expect them to be martyrs if you can't simply let them suffer the little things in life? I'm not perfect at this. I'm joined like a lot of others and say, I can't stand to see my child suffer. I won't allow it. And so when I found out a few of them were missing some of their precious items for camp, what did I do? I drove all that stuff up the mountain on Monday so that way they would have their stuff. But if we're going to imitate the Father, we need to think about, do we instill in them cultural toughness? Rarely will we need to allow vicarious suffering as Jesus underwent. But even in those moments, when our children are in the right and people are treating them wrongly, it might be good for us to let them suffer even that. What I'm trying to do here is merely suggest teaching a moral law that I've likened to gravity. Just as what goes up must come down, our children need to learn that choices have consequences and sin hurts. Even if it's not a sin they've committed, if someone else is committing the sin and I allow them to suffer underneath that sin, what it reminds them is, son or daughter, when you're sinning, this is the pain you're inflicting on others. You've tasted it before. You know how much it hurts. So may God help us to raise faithful children that glorify him. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we come to you this evening so thankful that you have allowed us to be able to gather in this place, to be able to worship together, read some scriptures together, sing songs together, and pray together, and to think about how it is that we can improve our efforts to glorify you through the raising of our children and our grandchildren. Father, please be with those who suffer the regrets and the frustrations and the guilt of the way that their children have turned out in adulthood. And Father, help them to be mindful and remember that even though you were the perfect Father and you provided the perfect environment, Adam and Eve still sinned.
And even though you found Israel, as Ezekiel describes it, like a baby who'd been discarded beside the road, and you picked her up and adopted her, you cleaned her off, you clothed her, you grew her up to be a beautiful woman. You were the perfect father for Israel, yet she too not only fell away, but fell away so quick and fell away so often. Help us, Father, to reflect on you, the perfect father, also going through the struggle of unfaithful children. Father, help lift them up. Help lift them up to have hope, and help them to renew their efforts of raising even their adult children still into their older years, but also especially to be focused on the grandchildren. And help them to plant seeds in their heart and in their mind. Help them to provide an example and a light that shows these children and grandchildren that there is a way of living for you that is rewarding, not just after death, but even in this life. Help them to see the peace that passes understanding when it comes to knowing your Son and living fully for Him, even through adversity and suffering. Father, thank you for having given us a church that is full of parents, both young and old, and those with great experiences of great variety. Help us to learn from them, Father, and not be arrogant. Help us be mindful of the fact that our job of parenting will never be over. As long as there are children of ours here walking the earth, we have a role and a responsibility to be merciful and loving and dependable so that our children know that we love them as you have loved us. So help us, Father, to make wise choices. Those of us who are much younger in our parenting, help us to think through how we'll spend our time, how we'll have our priorities, how we will allow struggle, how we will lift up and respect mentors in life so that we can have children that glorify you and not our own parenting techniques. We pray all these things in your Son's name. Amen.